The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is the Takeaway for Wednesday, December 7th, 2016.
This is the Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And what would you pay to protect a nation from this?
1, 2, 3, 4. Hello, NBC. We have witnessed this morning a severe bombing of Pearl Harbor by enemy planes, undoubtedly Japanese. The city of Honolulu has also been attacked and considerable damage done. It is no joke. It is a real war.
The first reports from Hawaiian media about the attack on Pearl Harbor 75 years ago today. And when they heard this voice, shocked Americans generally were relieved that this kind of national crisis was in the hands of a man they knew very, very well, three-term President Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
I believe that I interpret the will of the Congress and of the people when I assert that we will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery shall never again endanger us.
Question, is it our own internal treachery that threatens the security of the United States right now, or an outside attacker like the Japanese Air Force? We'll speak with Paul Sparrow, director of the Franklin D. Roosevelt Presidential Library and Museum, on how answering the attack on Pearl Harbor 75 years ago has defined America's role in the world in the 21st century. Of course, the time to ask the question, how much would you pay for security, is not when the bombs are falling, because then the price is infinite. In 2015, in a more sober moment, the Defense Business Board, a federal advisory panel that assesses defense spending, asked the same question, and the answer they got was $125 billion too much. This study, commissioned by Deputy Defense Secretary Robert Work and issued in January 2015, was quickly discredited and removed from the Pentagon website. Tina Jonas served as the Comptroller Undersecretary of Defense for the Department of Defense from 2004 to 2008. She doesn't dispute the $125 billion waste figure, although reaching that same amount in savings, she says, is probably a lost cause. Who is someone who loves lost causes? Perhaps President-elect Donald Trump. Jonas says the sheer size of the Pentagon would dwarf even the vast Trump organization.
It was very interesting for me to learn when I took over in my job that the Pentagon bought everything from floor wax to gauze bandages. I mean, it is an enormous operation. Clearly, the mission and purpose of the department is warfighting. But I think the arguments that are being made around this report and those that have expressed concern many years in the past is, look, we could do much better for our men and women in uniform by becoming more efficient, by adopting better practices, and I completely agree with that. The question is the scale and the timing of that and the energy that it's going to take. So are savings of this magnitude possible? It is potential and it's feasible. However, it's a matter of the timing. And I think the deputy secretary was Work was very concerned about what he called essentially taking what they call a wedge, which is taking savings ahead of being able to actually realize those savings.
But a confidential document that the Post quoted in this piece that we both read says that the Army employs 199,661 full-time contractors, and that's just the contractors. And that number exceeds the combined civil workforce for the Departments of State, Agriculture, Commerce, Education, Energy, and HUD. That just seems crazy on its face.
It is. There are 9 million people that are affected by the department's budgeting. That includes those who are retired and those who are in reserve and guard capacities as well. So, look, I am not defending 1 million people in back office. What I am saying is that the department is probably the most complex entity that I have ever been a part of. And it is easy to put together a study with some assumptions, and these were assumptions, and make some broad recommendations. It's a daunting job. Clearly more work has to be done by the new administration and should be done by the administration. But I cannot say with full confidence that I think that the report was completely thorough, or did the members of the Defense Business Board completely understand the complexity of the department.
The numbers of you that it has working in property management, the Pentagon is probably one of the largest property management companies in the world. If you just take HR, human resources, it's one of the largest human resources companies in the world. Did I vote for that? Did you vote for that?
I would vote today for greater efficiency. I think this clearly deserves examination by the new administration. And I am always one for showing and being clear with Congress and being transparent with the American public about the efficiency or inefficiency of an operation, and continued improvement is absolutely necessary. So, more to come, I guess, on this report. I'm sure that it will be looked at by the new incoming administration.
But if it was anybody else who was president-elect, anybody else, then we can't predict what Donald Trump's going to do ever, this wouldn't be going anywhere. It would just be another report floating through the Potomac, right?
It is certainly, they have certainly gotten everybody's attention. And so there are dozens and dozens of reports provided every year. You look at the acquisition studies that have been done. I think the clear question that American people are looking to get answered is, will things change? Will things get better? And I think they have a right to continue to ask those questions and demand accountability from the department.
Speaking to us from the West Coast, Tina Jonas is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and the former Comptroller Undersecretary of Defense for the Department of Defense from 2004 to 2008. Thanks so much, Tina.
Thank you.
Questions, questions, questions. Well, what does the jittery or joyful, depending on your politics, Beltway culture think about all this? $125 billion in savings?
Unbelievable.
I'm joined by Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Can they just count that money?
Oh, John, how many times have you and I been on this show over the last couple of years talking about sequestration and budget cutting, right? Lawmakers pitted against one another for, no, we want our defense priorities. No, we want our domestic programs, our food stamps, our farm aid, our health care for young kids. And they've been at each other's throats for every billion they can get because of mandatory budget cuts. And then to find out that there's not warfighting money, but back office bureaucratic money at the Pentagon that they could have cut. Now this is why the report was buried, because the bean counters at the Pentagon and perhaps the Secretary of Defense knew that Congress was at each other's throats for this money, and they would come for it if they knew about it. It wouldn't have floated by. If Congress knew this money was available, they would have come for it, and the Defense Department knows that. So do you want to know what people on the Hill, maybe on the Armed Services Committee, have to say about this? Here's a Claire McCaskill from Missouri, who spent the early part of her career sounding the alarm on defense procurement and contracting. Listen.
Unbelievable. I am going to get to the bottom of it. I'm going to demand the report. I'm going to demand the data. The notion that they asked for this study and then buried it is unacceptable.
There's Claire McCaskill. And if you hear the tone in her voice, sequestration, John, which I mentioned, you know, next year, the Defense Department is facing another $113 billion in cuts under current law. What does that mean? Another war between lawmakers with different priorities, where they're spending political capital, saving money. Here's Lindsey Graham, who's also on the Armed Services Committee from South Carolina.
If they did some of the things they said, they should be fired. They actually suppressed, you know, information. I don't know if that's true or not.
Firing a couple people in the Pentagon, that'll get us close. Let's see. I guess the average salary per unit of employed outside contractor is something like $189,000 per year. That's what they're paying.
They can save
two people. They could save, well, that gets you a quarter of the way.
Yeah, I mean, a demi-tasse in the ocean, right? When you read in the report, as you did, that the bureaucratic force here is about 1 million people in the Pentagon supporting 1.3 million actual active duty people. Now, John McCain is the chairman of the Armed Services Committee on the Senate side, of course. He says that they had seen part of this report, but he was furious also. Like, John McCain has spent also a career as Mr. Pork, you know, on the warpath about wasteful government spending.
We had just seen that report before, but we hadn't seen the database of it. So we just had a hearing on a littoral combat ship that was supposed to cost $200 million, ended up costing $460 million, and can't fight.
You know, the interesting thing here is the tone of what McCain is saying sounds like debates we've been having for decades. But I'm wondering, in the sequestration environment, does sequestration, if they can't get their act together to avoid it this time around, does that get us close to $125 billion in savings, and so this whole thing is moot?
Well, so under current law, as I said, $113 billion scheduled for next year. Nobody really believes that that's going to be cut out of the Defense Department. I mean, look at the Defense Department's own political position in Washington for the last 5 years. They've been running around saying, we are cut to the bone. You can't cut another dollar. Sequestration is killing us. It's starting to affect war fighting.
You read the report, though, in the Post about the guy who says you can't even get rid of the fellow serving butter in the chow hall in the local district, much less tens of thousands of jobs without backing from Congress.
No question. And here's the other part that the report doesn't mention, John. So many of those jobs, those are private contractor jobs or they're on military bases. And so many members of Congress have a personal stake, not their own bank accounts, but they're in their districts, they're in their states. These jobs are not all in Washington. Don't get it wrong. These people don't all work in the Pentagon. They work for contractors all over the country. So there's a huge perverse incentive here for everybody to keep this going because all of these jobs are in every state and every district across the country.
Well, Hans Willick, the likelihood that this is going to go anywhere, I mean, Trump will use this as an argument to do what he said he was going to do about Pentagon waste, right?
I mean, he certainly can, but this is bigger than just that argument because of sequestration, and Democrats have the ability to demand what they've demanded all along, which is if you're going to cut domestic programs that help, you know, working and poor people, you have to also cut military to the same degree. Don't put it all on the backs of domestic programs that people rely on. That fight continues. If there is another $125 billion in the Pentagon that can be saved, the debate will become, if we save half of that, does some of it go to domestic programs or do they pour it right back into tanks and trucks and boats?
Well, oddly enough, in this unusual political environment, they may stumble their way to getting to that $125 billion number. Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
To celebrate the 45th National Day for the Kingdom of Bahrain, what better place for the rich Gulf state and closest U.S. military ally to celebrate than Donald Trump's new Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C., which will host the festivities for a pretty penny. We think. We inquired with the Bahrain embassy about the exact price tag to secure the hotel for the event, week-long event, by the way, have received no comment back. A statement from Trump spokesman Jason Miller this week told us that to clear the air, in part, regarding such huge business deals, Donald Trump has sold all of his stock holdings in June, though those claims were not supported by any confirmation documents. Meredith McGehee is a strategic advisor at the nonprofit Campaign Legal Center. Meredith, this is a real gray area, isn't it?
It is indeed. Yet we have 40 years of experience with previous presidents who have moved to take these issues off the table. So I'm hopeful that that will happen with President-elect Trump.
But you can't really, I don't know how you insulate yourself from a business dealing that involves millions and millions of dollars in a very high-profile hotel that has the president's name on it in town for a national holiday that has nothing to do with the United States and everything to do with keeping the Bahraini regime in power.
Well, I think it's important to differentiate between the selling of the stocks, which did not have to do necessarily that we know of with the Trump enterprise. These were other interests. The remaining interests that there are in the Trump enterprise, some are foreign, some are domestic. And so it can be a very complicated financial situation. What's not complicated, and let's be very clear here, that around most of the world, finding ways to ingratiate yourself with the leader of a country or his or her family is the way business is done in most of the world. And this is part of what has set America kind of apart. It's been that shining city on the hill, is that our traditions and our cultures and our norms beyond our laws have ensured that this kind of ingratiation and enrichment of powerful elected leaders does not happen in our country.
Well, how much of this is very difficult to prove motive and maybe less difficult to prove actual behavior? For instance, if a diplomat in negotiations with the Trump administration over a military deal were to stay in a Trump hotel, does that constitute a violation of the Emoluments Clause in the Constitution?
Well, potentially, you have any time you have a foreign entity that is doing business with the Trump Enterprises, the Emoluments Clause could come into play. The lawyers are already having a field day trying to figure out how it would apply. But I would note that even President-elect Trump has noted that when you talk about conflicts of interest, there are two standards here. There's the actual conflict, and there's the appearance of a conflict. And even in his statement, President-elect Trump has talked about how it's visually important not to have these conflicts. The appearance is an important part here because it makes people question the motive. And, whether on the part of those people who are staying in the hotel or using the Trump facilities, but also in the case of the American people, this is even more difficult, I think, for the United States, because you have to remember that President-elect Trump, while he did win the Electoral College, did not win the popular vote. So there are going to be millions of Americans who are suspicious from the day one. And this is not the way to make sure that the focus is on the very difficult policymaking questions that remain. So the best thing we can hope for here is on December 15th that he does indeed announce a very strong policy for divestment and for a qualified blind trust, and that we just take these issues off the table so the questions about not only the motivations of Mr. Trump or his family, but also the motivations of those using his facilities would just be off the table so we can focus on the more important issues.
Meredith, what about the question of lost and found? I mean, does the FBI have to look at the lost and found at Trump hotels to determine if some gigantic gift came in there that would kick around for a while and maybe end up in the Trump organization at some point?
Well, this certainly would raise all kinds of questions, and I don't think anyone would probably touch that with a 10-foot pole. Because not only the questions of the Emoluments Clause, you don't know the source of where that is from, but also any other questions that would arise from any attempt to a bribery or any other kinds of activity. I'm not as worried, actually, about that aspect of it. I think, realistically, given what we've heard, the greatest concern here is that we've heard discussions, in addition to divestment and a qualified blind trust, is this notion of a firewall. And the only reason that creating a firewall between the president-elect and the business, or between the president-elect and his children and the business, the problem that I think we just have to see how this is going to play out is there is no legal definition of what constitutes a firewall. Who gets to define what that firewall is, and is it, in fact, addressing the problems? I think this notion that someone would leave behind the money, that would somehow accrue to the Trump Enterprises, is the least of our worries.
Well, the other question is, we're already, the sharks are in the tank at this point. Ivanka Trump has already met with Prime Minister Shinzo Abe while she had a financial, interest in her fabric company, her fashion company.
Mm-hmm.
We're already there.
We are there, and that's why this December 15th announcement is so critical, because already the questions have been raised, and this is a distraction from what we really need to be thinking about is a country that's so divided. And we need a president that the American people, whether or not you agree or disagree with his policies, there is some agreement that he is undertaking these policies and that his family is not abusing the power of the office for their own benefit. As I say, this is kind of what you expect in other countries. And this is the culture and norms of the United States about not having these questions raised is the way we expect our country to run. So I'm hopeful that on December 15th, those questions will be answered and answered in a positive way. Let's keep our fingers crossed.
Meredith McGee is a strategic advisor at the nonprofit Campaign Legal Center. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckabee. Now, Jared Sutton.
Hello.
You're in Greeley, Colorado?
Yes.
And like most of America and plenty of people in the world, you've been watching President-elect Trump or the elected president, Donald Trump, and his response to becoming the occupant of the Oval Office?
It's been very scary. The people that he's surrounding himself with to put in the cabinet, you know, ties to the alt-right. I'm a seventh grade math teacher here in Colorado, and we are very afraid of his nominee for Secretary of Education, very pro-voucher, which we feels like takes money out of public schools.
So, afraid
of what is happening.
For all of you listening, whether you're afraid or not, Jared Sutton is one of the very few people in the universe who actually can do something about the fact that Donald Trump is making decisions as president-elect in New York by appointing people and getting ready for his administration. Jared, you are an elector representing who or what?
So I'm one of the 9 Colorado electors. We select electors by congressional district. Colorado has 7. So I am the elector from the 4th congressional district or Eastern Colorado. And then we elect 2 at large. So it's like your 7 representatives plus your 2 senators. And so, yeah, I'm one of the 9 people in the state of Colorado that gets to vote on December 19th in our state capital, Denver, for president of the United States.
And the state of Colorado went for Hillary Clinton, I believe, right?
Correct.
So what do you want to do?
Well, first, I wanted to elect Hillary Clinton president. That has been my goal since the caucus. I voted for Hillary Clinton 6 times through this whole process, through all the primary process. I went to the Democratic National Convention, voted for her in the general election. But secondly, I would like to keep Donald Trump out of the White House. And so if there is some way by my vote that we can find another candidate, or I mean, either convince the Republican electors to vote for Hillary or a compromise of a different Republican, I will do whatever I can in my power to see that Donald Trump is not in the White House.
So the idea is to get an alternative Republican to be voted on in the Electoral College.
We felt like was a compromise. I mean, it'd be a much harder sell to try to convince Republican electors to vote for Hillary. So we're like, well, we realize that there are more Republican electors than Democrat electors. Maybe there is a different Republican that we could agree on and maybe build like a coalition government similar to what they have in the United Kingdom, where parties come together and have a prime minister when they're not in the majority.
What about selling this to other electors? What do they tell you?
I mean, I'll tell you right now on this radio show, the John Kasich seems to be the one that we get the most agreement on.
What do you think the reaction is going to be to, here we have a situation where Donald Trump is the presumptive president because he won the Electoral College vote on November 8th, but he didn't win the popular vote. Hillary Clinton won that by 2.5 million. You would replace Donald Trump with another Republican and think that's more representative of the voice of the people?
We are trying to keep America safe from Donald Trump. When I look at my students' eyes, my students are half Hispanic. They are scared to death. And we are trying to keep that man out of the White House. So, no, I would think a better candidate would be Hillary Clinton. But the thing is, I don't think we have enough convincing power to convince the Republican electors. If they were willing to come to that side, I would love to welcome them over here and sell that to the American people. I agree. The American people, I think, voted for Hillary Clinton, vote the way that the math works, which is frustrating that it's not the will of the people. It's just this crazy math game. But now we use these electors, and electors in many states can vote their free conscience, and we're challenging that in other states. And if that's true, the system is in place. We can choose who we would like to choose, and we can choose for the country. And if people don't like that, we should amend the Constitution.
The crazy math of the Electoral College being grappled with by a math teacher from Colorado. Jared Sutton is presidential elector for Colorado's 4th congressional district. Good luck, Jared.
All right, thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first 3 Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Voters in California legalized recreational marijuana back in November, meaning Californians can legally put up to 6 marijuana plants on their private property. But a lengthy permit process means the first retail stores probably won't open until 2018. We spoke with the first cannabis editor for the San Francisco Chronicle, David Downs, in advance of this ballot measure about the rapidly changing marijuana world across his state and across the world. Takeaway producer Isabel Angel is not our cannabis editor, but she is a native Californian and spoke to Downs about what this law means for her state of California.
On November 8th, about 56% of California voters voted to pass Proposition 64, which legalizes personal possession, use, transportation, gifting, and growing of marijuana for adults 21 and over. And it also kicks off a round of regulation and taxation for our state's robust multi-billion-dollar cannabis industry. So over the next year and a half, state and local regulators will be erecting a regulatory regime that'll hand out licenses to growers, distributors, retailers, everyone in the supply chain to create a tracked, controlled, licensed supply chain of cannabis that'll be sold to consumers starting as soon as January 1st, 2018.
And who are going to be the people tasked with doing these things?
In California, we have a really unique dual licensing structure. So cities and counties are in the driver's seat. They get to decide how much or if any medical cannabis or recreational cannabis activity they want to occur with a license in their jurisdiction.
So could we see really different ways of implementation in different parts of the state? You know, like the liberal areas could see an explosion of this, and in other, you know, more conservative areas, could we see less?
Yes, it's going to exactly be like the end of alcohol prohibition in terms of having wet and dry counties. I don't know if you've ever traveled across America and gone into a county with completely different alcohol control laws than other places. You're going to see a similar patchwork across California where we'll have jurisdictions, especially in the inland areas, the more conservative and rural areas, which will allow none or very little licensed activity. And then on the progressive areas in the coasts or up in the pot-growing heartland of America, Humboldt County, those groups are rushing forward to license and regulate a bunch of activity. Cities and counties are beginning to compete for the cannabis industry's, you know, money and trying to get the tax revenue that's associated with it. So, for example, little tiny desert towns like Adelanto and Cathedral City are licensing these mega farms and warehouses that are literally pushing out big defense contractors that want to make drones out there versus, you know, tons of little bedroom communities. They're saying, we don't want any of that. Keep that out of our quaint little town.
And how much money is this expected to make in California?
I saw a statistic yesterday where a researcher estimated that during the first year of legal sales in California, that'll be 2018, the state could make $777 million in cannabis taxes. That's just the taxes. I've also seen researchers say that the whole statewide industry could do $7.6 billion in sales by the year 2020. And that's just direct retail sales. That's not wholesale sales or the economic multiplier of all the other inputs that go into the industry.
And what about, you know, under a Trump administration, are we going to be seeing any effects on how this could be implemented going forward?
Sure, that's the $20 billion question in America right now, and everyone is furiously shaking their magic eight ball and looking for an answer. But the reality is we don't really know. President-elect Trump has said on the campaign trail that he's a states' rights guy who supports medical marijuana, but he's been stocking his cabinet with some of the more hardline anti-marijuana people in Washington, D.C. That includes his pick for Attorney General, Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama, who's on record as saying, quote, good people don't smoke marijuana. And that's significant in a country where 61% of Americans support legalization and something like 80% support medical marijuana. Some of his other picks have been equally a letdown to the cannabis community, but they're hoping that the states' rights pro-business side of the administration trumps the more conservative, reactionary, anti-marijuana, anti-civil liberties urges that they might feel.
David Downs is the cannabis editor for the San Francisco Chronicle. David, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Isabel.
Mixed Reviews, a romantic drama about inequality and injustice in Louisiana, a first-time director, an all-African-American cast. The feature film, Cane River, from the 1980s, has a premiere and then drops out of sight for decades. Not the most shocking story, But 2 years ago, a negative of this film, Cane River, resurfaced, and now the archival restoration group Indie Collect is in the early stages of restoring this film. In our week-long look at minority representation in entertainment, we spoke with the director's son, Horace Jenkins' son, Sasha, who was just 11 at the time of his father's death, has never seen a completed version of the film. He's a writer and filmmaker himself and is part of the restoration. He says making a film like Cane River in the early 80s was no easy task.
At that time, the early to mid 70s, you know, right before my father was doing his film, you had this strong era of blaxploitation films that were highly successful. And apparently the overall standard white mainstream film industry was hurting, and the blaxploitation film era ushered in a lot of money and kind of saved the film industry. And once the film industry realized, well, black people will go see The Exorcist, they figured that they didn't need to invest in these black films. So by the time my dad was focusing on his own films, you know, my father was primarily a documentary filmmaker. So the films that he worked on were about saying something. Even in this era, in 2016, it's hard to get money for films that are saying things no matter what color you are. And when my dad was doing his thing, it was extremely difficult.
What do you know about Cane River?
Well, it's a region in New Orleans, primarily occupied by folks who are of the quote-unquote Creole persuasion, i.e. black folks who are mixed maybe with some French heritage, with some Haitian heritage. And this region has been this way for hundreds of years. And my father found it interesting wherein, you know, he made films in Africa. He did a lot of things about the African-American experience. And I can only imagine that this time capsule that is Cane River was fascinating to him, particularly for issues of class and color amongst black folks.
And he found a financier for this film, which in many ways might have been the most valuable thing he did for black filmmakers, to connect with this benefactor. Tell me that story.
Well, what's great about that is the family who financed the film, the Rhodes family, they're a prominent black family in New Orleans. They'd been doing dignified burials for African Americans since right after the Civil War. They were a successful black family who believed in the vision of, you know, what my father was looking to put up there on the screen. And it was, I don't want to say it was luck, but they were very ahead of the curve in terms of any family, but a black family with money investing in something that was completely foreign to them on the business side.
What are your impressions of your dad's struggles and really the kind of culture he was in, both in and out of the commercial area and the places that he dreamed of finding audiences as a filmmaker?
Well, I think you have to look at the time where he lived. You're dealing with civil rights, racism, the CIA. My dad was all over the world. He was in the Middle East. He was in Africa. He was in all these places where black men at the time didn't travel, looking to do these stories that were connecting the black experience in America to the global experience or the African experience. The struggles that he dealt with weren't just societal or financial. They were emotional. They were physical. You know, we deal with so many issues today. Every day I'm seeing an African-American being murdered by the police. It's easy to say it's worse now than it's ever been, but I wasn't around then. I can't imagine the restrictions that my father had to deal with, not only as an artist or as a businessman, but as a black man.
What did he convey to you or leave behind that gives you a sense of what it must have been like for him to go to Addis Ababa, to Ethiopia?
You know, my mom is from Haiti, and she's a painter. And my father was a documentary filmmaker and a filmmaker, and he was a storyteller. So what they've both left for me was the sense of looking at myself, but also looking at things that go beyond money, things that go beyond status. I was taught to appreciate culture and see culture in all aspects of life.
What do you think the story of Cane River is, the place that Cane River has in this narrative of Birth of a Nation, that it's an answer to a much more controversial film that describes in wretched distortion the African-American experience. How do you fit into all of that?
I think it's a part of the larger narrative of making up for years and years and generations of propaganda and bad storytelling. I think that with all that's going on right now, there's an interest in these films, or at least there's interest from Hollywood in getting behind in spending money. Now, I'm not saying that Hollywood doesn't have a heart. I'm not saying Hollywood doesn't have an interest in making change. But Hollywood has an interest in making change, as in making money. So all of this stuff is topical right now, and there's a wave. Will the wave continue? I don't know. I hope it does. But I think right now, all of these black films that are coming from perspectives that we haven't heard are just making up for a lot of lost time. And I think the problem is African-American, black filmmakers, folks of color aren't considered Americans. Because if we were considered Americans, all of America would be extremely outraged by the way Americans of a certain color are being treated by the system or being treated by police departments around the country.
What's your wildest dream for Cane River? A restoration, a remake of Cane River with you at the directorial helm, or the making of Cane River, your discovery of what this film's all about?
Well, for me, the priority is to get my dad's vision out there in a way that it was never acknowledged. You know, me growing up in Queens with a single mom, I always told folks that my dad was a filmmaker, and it kind of went in one ear and out the other. Now, it's a great feeling to know that finally me and my dad can work on something together.
Sasha Jenkins is a writer and filmmaker, son of Horace Jenkins, who made the film Cane River. December 7th, 1941. It's the day the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, killing 2,043 Americans, wounding 1,178 more. The day the United States found the national resolve to finally enter World War II. It was 75 years ago. Here's Eleanor Roosevelt in an interview from the 1950s describing the first time she saw her husband, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, following the attack.
Almost the first thing he said to me was, with great bitterness and anger, that actually he had hardly finished talking to the Japanese envoys when this was being done in Pearl Harbor.
FDR's bitterness and anger gave way to a battle cry, though, that on the very next day set America on a course that in many ways we're still on.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Paul Sparrow is the director of the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Presidential Library and Museum.
We have to remember that this was a seminal moment in American history. You know, this was the worst day in Franklin Roosevelt's presidency, worst day in his life, worst military defeat in American history. And yet, you know, from that smoking wreckage emerged a great leader. He was able to lift the weight of the free world on his paralyzed legs and carry it into the future, and in the process transform America from an isolationist nation into a global superpower. At that point in 1941, America had the 14th largest standing army, you know, behind Sweden. We were not a significant military power, although Roosevelt had been attempting to prepare America for an eventual entry into this war. The American public was resistant. They were isolationists. The isolationists had a majority in Congress. So this was a transformative moment, and it laid the foundation for everything that's happened since then, both the evolution of the military-industrial complex and America as the world's policeman, but also 75 years of peace.
Was there talk at the time that Roosevelt's paralyzed legs wouldn't be strong enough to carry the nation through this crisis?
Well, there were certainly people who felt that he had misled America in the 1940 election. The 1940 election was highly controversial, the first time anyone had ever run for a third term. And there was great distrust of his wanting to become a dictator. They knew that he was a strong ally of Great Britain and Russia, and that he wanted to get in on the war on the Allied side. So there was some sense that he was not being totally honest with the American public during that election, but he was consistent and he said, you know, we will not get into this war unless we are attacked. And so he waited and waited for the attack. The criticism about him was that he might have had advanced knowledge of the attack, for which there is absolutely no documentary evidence, but it is a conspiracy theory that survives to this day.
Did he ever visit Pearl Harbor? Did he have close contact with the survivors and the wounded from Pearl Harbor?
He did visit Pearl Harbor later on in the war. He had a meeting there with General MacArthur and Admiral Halsey and the other military leaders in the Pacific conflict, although that wasn't until 1944. He had very close ties to the Navy. He had been the Assistant Secretary of the Navy during World War I, and he served under President Wilson. He was actually at the keel laying for the battleship Arizona, which of course was sunk at Pearl Harbor. He knew personally the captains of a number of the ships that were destroyed or damaged at Pearl Harbor.
What kind of leadership did FDR have to bring forth that wasn't already a part of his political life?
The key part of his leadership at this point was to get America to come together despite what had been extensive public opposition to getting involved in this war. So the speech was critically important. He was only going to have a few moments to take the American public and shift them from one point of view to the other. And he called his assistant in, Grace Tully, and dictated the speech to her. And as she described in her memoirs, he leaned back and he took a drag on his cigarette. And then he basically dictated the entire speech to her in one take, no stops, including punctuation. She then went and typed it up and brought it back to him. And he kept it with him for the rest of the day, and he would make these edits on it using pencil. And, of course, he made what's considered one of the most famous edits, you know, in presidential speeches, which the first line originally read December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in world history. And he crosses out world history and writes in the word infamy. And at that moment, he knew that after, you know, several years of trying to prepare America for the entry into this war, he now had to lead it.
I don't want to draw you into any controversy, but you know, looking back at our response to 9/11 and some of the things that have happened in my lifetime, why is the response to an attack like this to sometimes just go completely at odds to our core values, which is what the Japanese internment order was and what many have said the consequences of the invasion of Iraq has been?
Well, there's always that balancing act between national security and our liberties, our civil liberties. It is a specter who's reappeared throughout every major military conflict we've been involved in. Abraham Lincoln, you know, overturned habeas corpus, you know, in World War I, they were arresting newspaper editors who, or even people who were conscientious objectors. So this is a pattern of American behavior, where when threatened, Americans tend to sacrifice their civil liberties in the name of national security. I think what happens over time then is that people realize there is an overreaction, and then the pendulum swings back into a more balanced approach towards the importance of civil liberties, towards our core American values, and understanding that national security means nothing if we're not defending those things that we believe in. And that was one of Roosevelt's key points in his vision for the future. When he first came out with his Four Freedoms speech in January of 1941, he said, "We're fighting not for the British Empire. We're fighting for the freedom of speech, for the freedom of religion, for the freedom from want, for the freedom from fear, that an attack on freedom anywhere is an attack on freedom everywhere." And that's what he was trying to convince both the Americans and the global community of, and why this war was worth fighting. And I think we should always go back to that statement of his, which is that as Americans, we represent much more than just one country. We represent an ideal of democracy that people all over the world aspire to, and we have to understand that our actions have consequence, but our values are what motivate people all over the world.
Paul Sparrow, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Paul Sparrow is the director of the Franklin D. Roosevelt Presidential Library and Museum. And let's leave you with this moment of Roosevelt rallying the nation 75 years ago.
We are now in this war. We're all in it, all the way. Every single man, woman, and child is a partner in the most tremendous undertaking of our American history. We must share together the bad news and the good news, the defeats and the victories, the changing fortunes of war.
President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's fireside chat on December 9th, 1941. What would you say? How good are we at that sharing of the bad news and the good news, the defeats and the victories today in the changing fortunes of war and peace? Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Huckaberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.